You're listening to Radio Free Thinker, episode 69. Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver. Normally at this time, we'd have Don or Rob or Daniel come on and say, "Hi, I'm Don, and I'm Rob, and I'm Daniel." But they're not here! Fortunately, you don't have to listen to me by myself. I'm joined by two excellent local skeptics. One, Ian Cromwell, who is the author of The Cromulus Manifesto. Ian, welcome.
Hi, guys.
The other, we're joined by Jacob Lilyhall from the SFU Skeptics and recently returned from the CFI Leadership Conference in Amherst, New York.
Hi, Ethan. How you doing?
Great, Jacob. How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. Well, today we have a great show. We're going to be discussing some interesting news stories. We're also going to talk about the recent riots in Toronto. And then we're going to talk a bit about accommodation and confrontation in the skeptical atheist community. Before we get to that, let's meet our co-host a bit more thoroughly. Ian, how did you get involved in the skeptical movement?
That's actually a really complicated question. I was, like so many skeptics, raised Roman Catholic. I had the great fortune of not being in an authoritarian household, and I was encouraged to think critically about everything. The unfortunate, unforeseen consequence of that, of course, is that I began to think critically about everything. And so after many years of struggling with trying to reconcile a bunch of things that didn't make sense to me, I gradually made my way into the skeptical movement. I mean, my background is in science, so that part of my life was well established well before I made the jump to being a capital S skeptic. So I guess it's part of me has been a skeptic my entire life, and I think probably most people are like that. Most people are skeptical about some things, and I would hope so. Otherwise, we're going to be supporting a lot of Nigerian princes.
What about you, Jacob? How did you get involved?
My sort of into the world of the skeptics community was through magic. I started learning sleight of hand magic when I was pretty young, and that was a lead in to the efforts of people like James Randi explaining how the same techniques that I was learning were applied by other people to unwittingly sometimes, but to fool themselves and others into believing irrational things. So it was that sort of understanding that I gained from those analyses of how smart people can come to believe crazy stuff that I was then able to sort of eventually apply to religion.
And how did you get involved in the SFU Skeptics?
I got involved with the Skeptics. First, I was actually involved with what were going to be the SFU Freethinkers. There were three of us, and then our president absconded off to the United States, and that was the end of that. I met George Parker, the SFU Skeptics president and skeptic extraordinaire, in a cognitive science class that we had together, and we had the collective experience of being in this introductory CogSci class, and you know, there are people in that class that are on science tracks. George is a geography major, I'm a music major, and we were the ones defending correct scientific procedure. Not from the prof mind, from other students in class discussions. We found ourselves in the unusual position of kind of being the iron fist of materialism. Okay. on behalf of a professor who didn't have time to have that fight. So George fielded the idea to me, I think, of asked if I was interested in helping to start a group. And I said, well, I've tried once. It didn't go so well, but let's try again. And we did, and thanks to a lot of help from Justin Trottier, in particular with CFI Ontario, it's worked out a lot better this time.
Excellent. In fact, the SFE Skeptics are one of the most active skeptical organizations in Canada, and Jake was a big part of that. Well, let's get on to our news stories, some pretty wacky news stories, as usual here in Radio Free Thinker. The first one that caught my eye was apparently there's been a new study out of the University of Guelph that suggests that organic pesticides are actually worse than synthetic ones. Drumroll, please. So
yeah.
These findings are the result of a 2-year-long study that examined the performance of 2 natural pesticides against 4 synthetic ones on soybean aphids. And it turns out that the organic pesticides not only killed the aphids, but they're natural predators too. So far from being the, you know, bona fide Mother Nature loving, big farmer crushing, whatever it is they're supposed to be, they're actually not. They're not even that efficient at all. And there's a quote from the researcher, Rebecca Hallett: there is a general assumption among the public that if a compound is natural, it's going to be safer than something that's synthetic. This research shows that's necessarily not the case. I think she outlines pretty clearly the skeptical position on natural pesticides.
Sorry, Ethan, I just want to stop you there. Did she say that it's necessarily not the case or not necessarily the case?
Ian is right. Thank you for catching me on that one.
Because those are 2 very different things.
Yes. So organic farmers have responded to this study saying that it's irrelevant. They claim that if you're farming correctly, you don't need to use pesticides. Now, not being a farmer, I can't necessarily guarantee that, but I think that ultimately the goal here we're looking for is sustainable farming. And one aspect of being sustainable is to produce the maximum quality of food at the lowest cost of the farmer and the environment. And if organic pesticides don't do that, and the yield is smaller, then it's not really sustainable and not particularly useful to human civilization. I would imagine that everyone would agree with me on that one.
Awesome. Yeah, I think the big issue here is that the word organic is not regulated any way, or rather its use in marketing is not regulated in any particular way. I guess that's probably not true, but it's not well regulated.
It is in food products specifically. To market something as organic, you have to have there is a certification body.
But it's not, I think, as rigorous
as... Right, but the rules that are enforced by that body allow things like this to happen, where the pesticides you're allowed to use and say that your product is organic are the worst ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what I think the problem is that the rules that are in place that allow people to brand something organic or not incentivize using the worst pesticides so that they can market it in this way. So you have this disconnect between what's marketed as organic food and then these other really committed people who have some very different ideas about farming, i.e. if you're doing it right, you don't need pesticides at all, which I don't agree with, other than perhaps on a very small scale. But it's, they really are talking past each other here, right?
Yeah. You have one system that's using science, another system that's sort of relying on, I think, emotion and perhaps a political or economic ideology. Which is a shame, but this is, I think, a fascinating study, and I will certainly link this in the show notes so that our readers can double check it themselves.
Well, yeah, operating
is also there's other studies about this because Penn and Teller in their we'll say their television show on Showtime.
Yeah,
that did an episode on organic stuff, and this not this particular statistic, but this factoid was part of that. So I think there's probably actually a few studies on this subject that you could compare against one another if you were so inclined.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know that it's that I necessarily share your assessment that it's a shame that it's a political belief. I think the ideological belief is dangerous. If I market 100% certified organic bullets that come from iron ore that was not treated cruelly, and or I shoot you with synthetic rubber bullets, I mean, the belief that because it's natural or organic or comes from the earth, makes it somehow safe or safer than something else is in fact dangerous. But to say that because it's a political issue that it's also, that it's equally dangerous, I think we need to maybe crowbar a little bit of separation in between those two concepts, because I tend to be a little bit more of an optimist when it comes to people and think that people aren't necessarily bad, just poorly informed.
Right.
And if they're trying in an effort, I think in my own mind, it would be great if we didn't have to use any pesticides at all. That would be, you know, if food just grew and pests just kind of, you know, went somewhere else, that would be phenomenal. Since that's not possible, let's look at what we can do.
Right.
And so to say that it's that the political will to reduce the amount of pesticide use, I think that in this case, the organic pesticides are a misguided approach, because it turns out they are actually worse at protecting the environment, which, if that's the goal, mm-hmm. if the goal is something entirely different, if the goal is to sell more organic pesticides, then that's a separate issue. But I would think that the farmers and the people who consume organic food and the people who advocate for people who consume organic food aren't doing so out of a selfish interest in manipulating the market and making money. Some of them have profit as part of their motive. Everybody does. But the stated goals of the movement are about environmental conservation. And so in that, the organic pesticides fail. Mm-hmm. And that's how it is. But just because it's a political thing doesn't necessarily mean that it's negative.
Right. We'll have to see how the organic food industry responds to this sort of research and see where this takes them. Well, shifting gears a little bit, there's another story that I read that was just really caught my eye, and that's a Belgium police raid on a Catholic church. Now, there's obviously continuing to be a ton of controversy in Europe and North America as more cases of child sexual abuse come to light across the world. In Belgium, the situation has gotten a bit more volatile. Police in Louvain have seized nearly 500 files from a computer and are in a raid in the offices of a church commission investigating allegations of childhood sexual abuse. In April, the Bishop of Bruges, Roger Ballonneau, resigned after admitting he had sexually abused a boy more than 20 years ago. The police also searched the church headquarters in Brussels, the Brussels Archdiocese of Mechelen, just north of the Belgian capital. So they had a lead. They did an old-fashioned raid on a Catholic church. Now, during this raid, which the Catholic Church is quite incensed about, bishops were holding a meeting, and they were barred from leaving the premises for several hours, and they actually had their cell phones confiscated. The investigators also made holes in the tombs of two former Belgian primates at the Mechelen Cathedral and sent down cameras in search of any hidden documents. I guess the idea being that they saw the police coming, they were going to shove those documents into these old tombs or something. But they didn't find anything in the tombs. I'm not surprised, actually. But anyway, church officials, they're very outraged. The Vatican has even summoned the Belgian ambassador to the Holy See for an explanation. Now, I can understand, I guess, a little bit of the church's objections, but at the same time, I think this is exactly the right move. The Catholic Church has enjoyed a level of protection that I think is completely undeserved after the cases of sexual abuse have come to light. And this is precisely the kind of investigation that is required to determine the extent of the Catholic Church's involvement in the sex abuse cases, particularly in light of a possible cover-up by church officials to hide the abusers. Now, if the Catholic Church is upset about this, maybe they want to reconsider their interactions with local law enforcement. But what do you guys think?
I think the drilling into the tombs thing is a little crazy. I don't know quite. Like, I feel like maybe there's some other justification for this that we don't know about. But other than that, everything else, sure. I mean, the church has, it's not a possible cover-up. It is a demonstrable meticulously documented cover-up that did happen. So having spent not just decades, but probably centuries refusing to act on its own internally to police this stuff in really any way, I think the Catholic Church has little standing to object when a more conventional investigation is carried out.
What about you, Ian?
I would echo your sentiment about the tombs, although I don't know that it's I don't really share the taboo about death. I mean, once I'm dead, you can do whatever you want to my tomb. I don't really care. I'll be so far beyond caring. It's ridiculous. But
I just thought it was weird.
It's weird. Well, first of all, it's weird that they would bother to drill into a tomb and look for a camera. But it's also, I think it's excessive, and I'll say why. I think it's excessive that if you know, Enron or Microsoft or some other company that had been shown to have some cover-up, for some bizarre reason, this is going to be a kind of a strange thought experiment, had tombs in their company property.
Oh, they probably do.
Well, okay. Yeah, all right. So, in the secret boneyard of Microsoft, the act of disturbing a tomb doesn't affect the dead person, but it does affect those who are still alive to witness it. The tomb, the reason that we, you know, ensconce our dead is not for their own sake. It's for the sake of those who are still left alive and to preserve a memory. The idea that in another organization, that Belgian police or police in general would have they would go ahead and just drill into a grave. It seems odd, and my concern is not only is it, it's just because they've done some unbelievably horrible things, it's not justification for some sort of retributive drilling into tombs. I mean, the very idea is a bit ridiculous. But
what makes it so weird is how slim their chances were of actually finding anything that way. That's what makes it really strange to me.
If they had to drill in, then presumably there's no access to the tombs anyway. So how could these priests have shoved documents into them if they couldn't open the lid? I think there's, in most cases when something really bizarre like this happens, in my experience, there's more to the story than is being told. And my guess is that the Belgian church had been more forthcoming and more cooperative, there wouldn't have needed to be a raid. That doesn't excuse the actions if they were in fact excessive, which I think they were, but I'm not in possession of all the facts.
Yeah, we don't know nearly enough about that particular tidbit, I suspect.
Exactly. So, but if, in order, try not to necessarily blame the church here, it seems to me that there's a general culture, and I'm sure that this is not, I'm not going out on a limb here to suggest this, that there's a general culture of secrecy and refusal to cooperate with secular authority. That's been the hallmark, one of the hallmarks of the church. So the trick is, and this is not just for this particular case, but in the general establishment of a secular society that truly respects the rights of individuals to have their own personal beliefs, once you know that, provided they don't harm anybody, if you're going to be persecuting, I don't want to use that word. I want to use a different word that means the same thing.
Prosecuting.
You sure? Well, yes, but going after a group because they've done bad things in the past. Just not because it's the law, but because you don't like them. I think we have to be very, very, very careful to avoid even the perception that that's the case, because then there's going to be huge pushback, not just from the church, but from all religious groups and all religious people who say, this is a perfect example of how Christians are being persecuted by a secularist agenda, which is a bunch of nonsense, but it's not perceived to be nonsense. And so I think that in that particular case, they failed to model a good example of establishing secularism.
Okay, well, that's a excellent take on this. Why don't we go to a quick commercial break? And I know I promised that Don was not going to be on the show today. He did send us some pre-recorded segments, and we'll definitely get to those when we get back from commercial here on Radio Free Thinker.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Priming the Pump with Dawn. For those not familiar with Priming the Pump, we are planning to do a segment in a future show, maybe the next one, where we'll be taking a skeptical look at the G8 G20. To make this the best show possible, we're hoping to get you, our listeners, to send us your thoughts and comments about the issues to sort of prime the pump or discussion, making our show on the G8 G20 more what you're looking for. As those of you who have not had their head in the sand, this past weekend saw the G8 and G20 events go off in Toronto. For those of you who don't know what the G8 or G20 are, let me explain. The G8, originally formed in 1974 as the Group of Six, or G6, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, the UK, and the USA, then the G7 when Canada joined a year later, then the G8 when Russia joined in the 90s. The idea was to have the chief financial ministers of each country meet on an annual basis to both coordinate international trade and treaties and to work out disputes and crises that may have arisen. Originally, for the finance ministers, it has become a photo op for heads of state. The G8 were, in many ways, an extension of Western colonialism via liberal capitalism. In response to growing criticism by the new emerging economies, such as India, Brazil, and South Africa, the G20 was created. Its purpose was the same as the G8, but more inclusive. As things tend to be, the G8 was not dissolved in favor of the G20, but persists as a kind of pre-meeting so the Western nations can present a united front to the G20. These events have a history of attracting protest. Our government, having decided to host the G20 in downtown Toronto, spending over $1 billion for security, and essentially closing downtown Toronto for a week. During the event, there were many confrontations between state authorities and public protesters. That all said, we hope to take a skeptical look at some of the issues surrounding the event. So let us know what you think about, well, is the G8 or G20 a PR stunt? Or a useful coordinating tool for the global economy? Was Toronto turned into a fascist state? Or did anarchist thugs run roughshod over the city? Was the media an unbiased recorder of history? Or an agitator of violence for the sake of sensationalism? Was $1.2 billion spent on security a sign of Canada's strong economy? Or a huge waste of money? Was Toronto selected as host city to improve the city's prestige? Or to punish it for not voting conservative? That last one wasn't me. I heard that on the CBC or CTV. Anyway, send us your comments or suggestions to radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Okay, back to you guys in the studio. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another remote note from Dawn. Today, I'm going to share with you a news item I heard on a trip to Winnipeg on the CBC. The spot I heard was about Christian Bach and his new work, The Xenotext Experiment. As our loyal listeners may remember, we discussed earlier this year Craig Venter and his development of synthetic life. This process involves, if I may use imagery for fact, using a kind of inkjet printer to print a DNA sequence or nucleus. The Xenotext experiment is parallel to this work, but takes it into an entirely different direction. In Christian Bach's abstract, a link's available on our website, he mentions that cybernetics experimenter Patrick Wong et al. Have already encoded into the DNA of bacteria the song lyrics to It's a Small World After All. It's Bach's plan to encode into the extremophile Deinoculus radiodurans a line of poetry. From those who don't know what an extremophile is, it's a branch of life that has learned to live in the most extreme environments. These include boiling waters near geysers and thermal vents, and extremely salty waters, like the Dead Sea, in the cooling tanks of nuclear waste plants. If it's a place you're sure life could not possibly exist, an extremophile lives there. Bach's idea, from what I've read, is he's planning to use DNA as a form of cryptography or code, with three base pairs equaling one English letter. From that, he will encode a complete poem. Further, he plans to encode some DNA that will produce proteins that will contain its own encoded poem snippet. That is, the DNA will produce a protein, and in that protein will be a code that can be translated into a poem itself. So just not the DNA is being encoded, but some DNA is also going to be encoded to create proteins that will encode a poem. Sort of a meta-poem. The plan with creating protein poetry is that as the organism evolves, the protein will also evolve, and in doing so, change the poem. The DNA he is adding, or changing, is not important active DNA, but the junk DNA. He states that, and I quote, "The genome can now become a vector for hitherto unimagined modes of artistic innovation and cultural expression. In the future, genetics might lead to a possible literary dimension to biology, granting every geneticist the power to become a poet in the medium of life." I think this is interesting in three ways. First, some people were worried with regards to the synthetic life of Ventnor that we would be creating a monster like Dr. Frankenstein did. I don't think so. But because the purposes of this experiment is the manipulation of DNA for artistic reasons and not relative to its function, you can't be too sure what its outcomes will be. He hopes to avoid these issues by focusing on that junk DNA. But as I heard in a recent podcast on NPR, to geneticists, there is no such thing as junk DNA, only DNA we have yet to understand its function. Secondly, one of the technical people on Bach's experiment is Stuart Kaufman, a geneticist who believes life is complex but predisposed to order, that there's an underlying tendency to self-order. I worry that if this experiment is successful and we have bacteria composing sonnets, that the intelligent design nuts will take this as proof of the hand of God. Lastly, and the part I found most exciting, is the potential for the extension of both human culture and knowledge. If this experiment works well, and the encoded poem has an indefinite life, that is, the information encoded in the genome is extractable as long as the species exists, think of what this could mean when we look beyond poetry. As Ethan and other students of history know, throughout our past, humanity has on several occasions taken into its collective mind to destroy its own reservoirs of knowledge. Be it the destruction of the Library of Alexandria, the sacking of Rome, or book burnings in the 1950s United States. Now, we could have the potential to ensure human knowledge is next to impossible to lose. Imagine encoding the complete Library of Congress in an extremophile. As long as that life exists, knowledge exists. Even if an asteroid hits the planet and resets the life as it did with the dinosaurs, whatever intelligence that arose in our place could retrieve that knowledge. Extremophiles are also believed to be a source of exogenesis. Imagine one of these encoded extremophiles being hurtled into space as part of some meteorite and landing on fertile soil in some distant solar system, giving rise to a whole new biosphere, an Earth 2, if you will, literally life with knowledge in its genes. But enough of my flights of fancy. What do you think about literary genetics? Back to you guys in the studio.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie, to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver with Ian and Jacob. So we're going to be talking a bit about confrontation versus accommodation. It's an old argument in the skeptical community, but what is the best way to advance our cause? Now, before we jump into that, I want to thank Dawn for those excellent bits, and I look forward to discussing the G8 and G20 talks in Toronto, where I was not too long ago. But confrontation versus accommodation, what does that mean? Let's give a quick definition of these two ideas, and I invite Jacob and Ian to correct me if I'm wrong. But confrontational skepticism or atheism is a brand of skepticism or atheism that is confrontational in nature. It involves an active promotion of being a skeptic. It might be the atheist bus campaign or wearing those A buttons or confronting pseudoscience like handing out flyers at a Deepak Chopra event or running a snarky blog. Accommodation might be more friendly, inclusive, toned down, designed to make people feel not like an idiot for not agreeing with you. Principles of accommodation skepticism is, you know, writing a magazine that is inclusive, encourages communication with multi-faith leaders or involving naturopaths or homeopathy practitioners when you write a blog, for instance. It's designed to not turn the movement into an us versus them mentality. Now, the reason we're talking about this is because, as I mentioned at the top of the show, me and Jacob were at the CFI Leadership Conference, and there was a talk there, and it was a little controversial, kind of divided the audience. And Jacob, why don't you discuss this talk for us?
Yeah, so the talk was by a woman named Heidi Anderson, who is, I guess, I had never heard of her before, but she's been involved with the skeptics community for a very long time. And she gave a talk that had one really good point, I thought, some stuff that I wasn't that interested in. But the result was that during the Q&A session, it got really ugly. When you have a bunch of skeptics in a room, usually if there's a disagreement, you know, they were very upfront about it as a community, but this got really personal and just really ugly. So the main thing that provoked that response was her kind of attack on the confrontationalists, which is, you know, sort of an interesting thing in principle. But there are a lot of people at that conference, or a lot of people in the community in general, who feel that we should give no ground, either intellectually or rhetorically. P.Z. Myers is a good example of this attitude. No compromises when it comes to the facts, when it comes to the science. So, and to me, that's kind of what, it's not just confrontational, this particular style. I think it has to do with not tolerating, you know, not saying, for instance, oh, they can believe in some theistic version of evolution, that's good enough. They tend to say, no, evolution leaves no room. There's no place where a deity is necessary, and therefore we're not going to brook any incursions into the theory by theology. So this netted a really nasty response for her. The first part of the talk was mostly just kind of internet drama that didn't help. I think it riled up the crowd more. But she did make one really important point about this argument, and that is, if I may synthesize, apologies to Heidi if I get this wrong, that as skeptics who have goals, we are also equipped with the tools to evaluate the methods we are using to accomplish those goals in terms of how effective they are in the real world. There is a real answer to the question, is accommodationism or confrontationalism more effective for a given set of goals? That question we can answer. We can measure our success and really evaluate them, and we should be doing that. And I think that it's true that we have learned to talk about these tactics in a pretty lazy way. I do see a lot of rhetoric coming from the community saying, the confrontationalists are just turning people off. P.Z. Myers isn't converting anyone. He's just turning people off of skepticism and making everyone think all atheists are angry. And on the other hand, oh well, the accommodationists are poisoning the well. They're sabotaging the movement. It's not worth it if we win. But in the end, the science has been tainted by all this other stuff. So that seems to be the general tone. And what I haven't seen are a lot of clear statements about what exactly we're hoping to accomplish, what it would look like if we accomplished it, and then sort of a more sober evaluation of how best to go about that.
So, Ian, what's your take on this?
Well, I mean, I think you said a mindful, if not a mouthful. The idea being that there's no... Without the actual statement of what the goal is of the skeptic movement, or of the two different—I mean, I don't buy the two camp argument to begin with. To say that there's a group of accommodationists and a group of confrontationalists, I think it's an arbitrary designation that's been drawn. But I think of it in terms of this is perhaps a very strained metaphor and perhaps an unfortunate one. But if you've got two armies confronting each other on the battlefield, and I want to state unequivocally here that I do not think that we are in an ideological war. I think we are in an ideological conflict, but we're not trying to kill anybody. But you'll have your foot soldiers and you'll have your archers. And the foot soldiers and archers both have to be there, because if you have just the one, your army is going to get wiped out. There needs to be a balance. And there are, to bring the metaphor perhaps a little closer to reality, people don't respond to arguments in a uniform way. As much as we like to think that we are inherently rational and logical beings, we're not. There's an unbelievable amount in the scientific psychological literature to suggest that people use heuristics and biases and preconceived notions of how things seem to work and rely on them, in many cases, more than the facts that are presented to them. So, in that sense, there will be people who don't respond to a reasoned argument. They will not do it. So the only way to confront someone who's being swayed by a non-reasonable argument is to appeal to that heuristic, to show them that there is another way of looking at it. An example is homelessness. And people say, oh, there's this really handy heuristic of the lazy homeless guy, that the reason that people are on the street is because they're lazy and if they just got jobs, and that anyone who wants to house the homeless just wants to take hardworking taxpayers' money away from them and give it to lazy people. And you can't confront that kind of, I'm using air quotes here, which are not particularly effective on the radio, but that kind of logic, you can't counter that with, well, actually, if you look at the statistics, you'll find that social housing programs enhance the quality of life, and actually when you decrease the discrepancy and inequalities between the highest income earners and the lowest income earners, everyone, including the highest income earners, benefits. You can't counter that argument like that. You got to come with another argument and say, well, you just want people to die, or whatever. I realize that, I mean, even as I say it, I'm not a fan of it. But I recognize the fact that not everyone is going to respond to a logical argument. So instead of saying which is the more effective one and which one should the skeptical community adopt, I think there needs to be, I think both, I sound like an accommodationist now, there need to be several different approaches that different types of people will respond to, because people use their heuristic and intuitive reasoning faculties with different levels of reliability. Some people rely solely. So when you cancel both types of arguments out, the only thing that's left is to go and look at what the evidence says. So when logic is countered by logic, when you can't move any farther, or when heuristics or a values argument are countered by a values argument, and you can't move any further, there's values on both sides. You have to look at the evidence, because that's, and in that sense, skepticism will win every time, because by definition, it's based on interpretation of evidence.
Ian, in your own blog, have you encountered sort of a difference, say, in the response to when you post, say, something a bit more snarky and a bit more factual? You notice something in, say, the comments or the response from your friends and readers in the community? Can you tell when you've provoked people to be snarky, or when you've provoked people to go, that's a good point, I'm going to think about this?
Well, I mean, I have to confess that my blog, crominess.wordpress.com, it doesn't get a ton of traffic. I mean, we're not talking about it. It's not for Angular. It's not.
But it has been on for Angular.
It has been for Angular twice, which I'm extremely happy about. But I don't get a whole lot of comments, and I find in the non huge blogs that I go to, we don't see a lot of comment density. But I can speak to the handful of times when a couple of weeks ago, I did an interpretation, a bit of a send up of Bernard Russell's Teapot. This is a thought experiment in which you're invited to consider that there's a teapot orbiting somewhere between the Earth and Mars, but it's so small and moving so fast that it is, by definition, impossible to detect. But you can't detect it, so you can't prove that it's not there, and therefore you must believe in it. And I took one step further to say, but not only that, I'm also going to tell you that I know things about the teapot, that I know that it has a chip on its handle, and that it's white with blue flowers, and that it wants you to not have sex with people whose names start with R, and so on and so forth, that there will be these specific things that I'm going to attribute to a teapot that you can't see, but because you can't prove it's not there. And so I developed this argument, and I basically, I try to keep it as low snark as possible, just to say that when someone calls themselves an atheist, they're not saying that they believe that there is no God. They are saying that they lack a specific belief in one thing. So I am a teapot atheist. I don't believe that there is a teapot there. And this is something that Richard Dawkins has used several times. Bernard Russell, it's a favorite, but I tried to reinterpret it along my own lines. And a columnist from Baltimore, a guy who I met on an unrelated skeptic blog looking at science-based medicine, commented, and he was saying, you know, man, those, you seem really angry. And I looked through my posts and I said, I don't see anything angry in here. I don't know where you're getting that from. I mean, I don't think that people are crazy. I think they're just, you know, they're deluded. And he just, as soon as I said the word delusion, he just lost it. And he started talking about, oh, you're just quoting Dawkins and he's your prophet and all this. And I said, okay, well, you know, we ended up going back and forth, but I mean, we like each other. So we kind of just let it go. I got the last word because it's my website, but I know that a lot of the time the perception that atheists are angry, and maybe this is not directly related as an answer to your question, but perhaps the discussion at large, that there's a perception that atheists or skeptics of any kind, because you don't necessarily have to be an atheist to be a skeptic. It's just that if you're a theist and a skeptic, you're really not doing a very good job with being a skeptic. Not doing a thorough job. And so the assumption is that because you're not willing to listen to everyone who says anything, you know, that talks out of various orifices of their body, that you're somehow angry or resentful or hateful, it's not because it's based in reality. It's a perception because I disagree with you, and therefore I'm going to make you responsible for my disagreement. So I haven't had too much experience with having to battle with accommodationists or people who think you should be nicer. I did have a conversation with my dad once, which I thought was pretty informative, where I asked him, we were talking about reasons for or reasons against belief in God. He was a Catholic priest in a previous life, not in a reincarnation sense, but in a life faith sense. And he was saying, you know, you can't just call people stupid, which I hadn't done, but he's my dad, so I wasn't going to really correct him. He said, you know, you can't just tell people that what they believe is stupid. And I said, but dad, it is. It's fundamentally illogical. The whole thing is illogical. And he said, you know, you should be more humble and you should be nicer. And I said, okay, but here's the question. If I was nicer, if I was more humble, would I be any less right? Does me being, in your eyes, really arrogant or pushy, does that make what I'm saying wrong? And he said, no, but you probably wouldn't say it. Well, I mean, at that point, I kind of started laughing, because it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard, that it doesn't matter whether something's right or wrong, or whether there's fact, or whether it's, you know, the argument is good. It's about the person saying the argument, not the argument itself. I found that idea to be somewhat telling, because I'd seen it various places before, but I'd never heard it put so precisely.
Okay, well, why don't we take a quick commercial break on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with some more on the confrontation versus accommodation debate.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey, what are you doing this Saturday? Tune in to Beats from the Basement, starting at 11 p.m. till whenever. Bring you the freshest in new school and old school hip-hop, funk, electro, freaks, and whatever else tickles our toes. Where are you going to find it? On your home of rad, CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up on this
Saturday. Saturday is a Saturday.
Beats from the Basement for 11:01. Blah 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 blah. Pencil.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, talking about accommodation and confrontation. So, Jacob, getting back to Heidi's talk, what were some of the criticisms that were put against her and her sort of thesis statement that we can damage the movement by being snarky or confrontational?
Well, other than some sort of off-topic, immature stuff about her appearance and that she was strident and whatnot, there was a salient criticism in that she made a big point of demanding evidence from the more aggressive spokespersons of the movement that their way worked, without providing any of her own that the other way worked. But that doesn't concern me that much, because I had not heard this point of hers articulated this way before. So I kind of thought that rather than spending mental energy on the parts of the talk that weren't that great, I think there's a big discussion to be had about this point, about how to measure our success, how to gauge how well we're doing. Because it's complicated, and in order to just sort of harken back to what's been said before, there aren't just two sides to this, and part of what defining our goals will mean will be figuring out, getting a really firm grasp of what it can mean to make progress.
So what kind of benchmarks of accomplishments that you want to see, that you think that we can scientifically measure?
Well, the way that these things typically are measured is it's messy. It's the way they do it in public opinion polling and in advertising. It's not really that instructive to ask people the question, well, what do you think of atheists? But we do have the statistics on whether people would vote for an atheist for president. And you can show people a video and tell them that the person speaking is an atheist, or tell them that there's something else, and, you know, give them that little knob that they can twist to show how much they approve or how much they feel positively or negatively as the footage progresses. So there's all these kinds of tests that are very well used in many other areas that give us some solid empirical data from which to infer other things. The problem, of course, is it's hard to do and it's expensive. But I think, I was thinking how to apply this to the SFU skeptics, because of course we don't have them anywhere near the means to conduct even a good survey of just on campus, which would not really be that instructive. But if we do set benchmarks for ourselves of, just in a non-scientific way even, what it would look like if we made a certain amount of progress in one area. One good benchmark for me, just off the top of my head, is if people responding in discussions with atheists that are recorded used words like angry less. So if atheists were accused of being angry less in conversation, I think that would be a mark of progress. Because I think for the most part, it is unwarranted. It's just a reflexive thing that means you're making me uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not certain, additionally, that being quote-unquote nicer is the way to do it.
Right. I'm recalling that the SFU skeptics have a banner that is a take off of the Richard Dawkins atheist campaign, "There probably is no God now, move on and enjoy your life," or something to that effect. And the SFU skeptics put that banner up regularly around SFU. What's been the response to that banner? Because that's a very confrontational thing to do, I would think.
We consider it quite a positive slogan, which is why we put it up. The first thing that happened was that the individual at the SFU print shop where it was made, in charge of installing the grommets, wouldn't do it. I don't know who was there that day. We didn't get to talk to the person. The person in charge of printing was fine. They just did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually lent us the tools to install the things ourselves. So there was really no problem. But that was the first indication that people had like stronger feelings about this than we really expected. And then within a day of putting it up, it was kind of mildly vandalized. They didn't damage the banner itself, at least not directly, but we had it strung up with some ropes somewhere in the academic quad, and they cut through the ropes and kind of just set it down on the walkway there. So it was crumpled up. It wasn't handled carefully, and vinyl sort of has to be. So it looks a little shabbier now, but whoever this person was must have had a sharp object in their hand, and they didn't use it to directly deface the banner. So
it's very Christian of them.
Yeah. So I don't know what we don't know what their motivation was, it was a little weird. After that, we mostly kept it in the glass cases here. There's been no problem with it since. I've sat and watched people go by and just sort of looked at their reactions to it. A lot of people smile. A few people kind of look a little miffed. And
did they shake their fists at it?
No one has shaken a fist or made the sign of a cross. but actually, what I have seen that's very encouraging is I've seen on several occasions people standing near it talking about it.
That's probably a positive, I would think.
Yeah, that is, I think, actually the best reaction that we could hope for, not just to provoke some thought in an individual, but to get two or more people to discuss it that's the best we can hope for. And actually, that would be another benchmark of success, I would say, is if discussions of these topics, like pseudoscience and religion and rationality, come up more often in public discussions that aren't being pushed directly by us. I'd call that another good indicator that we're doing something right, assuming it can be attributed to us in any way. Right.
Jacob, I want to break in because I think you said a couple of things, a couple of very interesting things, and I just want to. There's a branch of scientific inquiry that's sort of fighting for credibility in real estate. It's called qualitative analysis. This is where you take the narrative, the actual words that people say in things like focus groups or one-on-one personal interviews, and you perform analyses on them. You do kind of a trend analysis. You break it down into its constituent topics. One of the women that I work with is a specialist in this kind of inquiry. And I think that's another, perhaps less utilized, but far more cheap and effective in terms of structuring the narrative and determining what the subtopics are. And you can do subtopic analyses, and then you can blend, you can do mixed method analysis, where you find the frequency of a subtopic, and then you do an event, and then you check and see when you do another focus group or more one-on-one interviews, how that has changed. So I think it's an interesting question of how would we go about doing that specifically, and I would offer that as a specific suggestion on another method that could be used rather than trying to use market research, which tends to be more, you know, dial in a room with a screen and a can of Coke kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, qualitative analysis is actually quite prominently featured here at SFU because our communications department sort of deals with it. It's sort of an unusual department.
Maybe I'm sort of leading with my chin there when I say that it's fighting for credibility. That I work in health research, and so in that domain specifically, it's not quite as prevalent, but it's becoming more so. The other thing I wanted to just briefly say is I think we have to be honest with ourselves, and maybe I'm projecting here, but when I write something that's snarky, to use that phrase, something that's not nice, something that's more confrontational, I do it full well knowing that I'm going to be engendering a reaction in my audience. And I use it as a tool specifically to move people out of a comfort zone. And when we put up a banner, I'm now including myself in the SFU skeptics, even though I am not a member.
You're more than welcome.
Awesome. when a group does something like that, I think it's unfair both to other people and to yourself to say it's weird that someone would cut it down or that people would be angry or miffed. I don't think that it's weird at all. I think that's the reason why you do something like that. You put up a banner because you know it's a confrontational slogan. You don't expect people to go, huh, well, that's the poster says so. So, fine, awesome. Spot. See you later, God.
SFU is a pretty apathetic campus.
I think
the thinking that we had going into it was more we had considered it as a message to our potential membership. Essentially, a lot of people come to SFU, they see the 50 religious clubs and no secular representation until us, at least for a few years.
Sure.
And they have remarked to us when we've been tabling, wow, you know, I came here last year and you guys weren't here and it was just the religious clubs, and I felt really sort of unwelcome. So the banner was meant as a signal to those people. I think we had it in our minds, if anything, at least I did, that the religious people weren't especially going to care.
Fair enough.
I had never seen anyone at SFU do anything like that. And when they did it, it was still kind of half-hearted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. But what was I going to say? So about being sort of strident, and more about other people being unreasonable. I feel this way because my entry into this world was through the world of pseudoscience. It's not necessarily the case that people are being very unreasonable when they believe very unreasonable things, because I feel to understand why people can be convinced to believe nonsense. You need to have some fairly specific knowledge of cognition and psychology and history. So this is, I think skeptics are people who learn these things, and you can kind of do it by pure logic maybe, but it sure helped me to understand why really smart people can be fooled by something like cold reading being performed by someone who also believes in it. I think that kind of situation makes it easier to observe it and not be angry, because there's no one to blame there. There's this mutual reinforcement, and while they could figure it out, the emotional pressure is very strong not to. And in many cases, especially with things like psychics and those really eye-catching demonstrations of paranormal stuff, it's getting the information actually available to them. I think some people who believe in these things may actually be believing reasonable, given the information they have. And as such, it is our job to make more information available to them. But it's possible to go through all the right motions of believing reasonably and arrive at the wrong conclusion if your information is bad. Garbage in, garbage out, right?
Right. Well, Jacob, Ian, I got to thank you guys for coming by today. We're almost out of time, so I want to go to our skeptical highlights. And I got a really, really good one this time. Lawrence Krauss, the world-famous astrophysicist, is coming to Vancouver to give a talk, and he's going to be giving a talk for CFI called A Universe from Nothing on July 3rd at 7 p.m. here at UBC in the Woodward Building, room number 2. You can get your tickets online at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver. Reserve your tickets. There's going to be reception afterwards, so I encourage you to go to that. It's going to be very awesome. You're going to get to hang out with Lawrence Krauss. And remember, as a CFI member, you will get in free, so I encourage you to sign up if you're not already a member. Jacob, quickly, are there any events the SSU Skeptics are putting on?
Well, the only one I know about for sure that's going to be done in the near-ish future is this September for incoming freshmen at SFU. I and hopefully a few others will be collaborating on a sex and skepticism talk to better equip our incoming students at SFU for their time here. So that promises to be a lot of fun and make people sort of nervous and giggly.
Excellent.
So that's off the top of my head all I know about because I'm in the process of trying to write it.
Excellent. Well, Ian, what was your blog again?
It's Cromunist, Cromunist at wordpress.com.
Right. Well, gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me today. And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.